Welcome to Season 2 of The Straight and Marrow, a podcast that discusses all things allogeneic bone marrow transplant, from pre-transplant considerations to survivorship, using experiences of healthcare professionals, patients and carers, with current evidence to keep it straight. The Straight and Marrow is sponsored by ARROW, the Bone Marrow Transplant Foundation. ARROW's mission is to improve the survival and quality of life for bone marrow transplant patients and to provide support for carers.
Good morning. Welcome, Yvonne. Welcome, Jacinta.
Thanks, Alex. Good to see you and welcome, Jacinta.
Thanks for having me.
We have a very special guest today, Jacinta, who has had a bone marrow transplant, but actually maybe I'll let you introduce yourself.
Okay, so my name's Jacinta. I am, I guess, most relevantly to this podcast, someone that has survived and thrived post-allogenic stem cell
survived
transplant.
Survived and thrived. Yeah. We love that.
Yeah, second life, second birthday. So I'm now a principal lawyer at Maurice Blackman Lawyers in their social justice team. I hang around Brunswick a lot and I love Melbourne.
Perfect. How old are you from your second birthday?
My second birthday was the 13th of I think June or July 2013. So I'm nearly
you're 10.
Yeah,
double digits.
10 and a half. Yeah.
So very exciting.
Yeah. So that's how long we've known each other for.
I know, and it's amazing because you move on with life, but you hold your treatment team in such high regard as you sort of traverse these different modes. So it's really lovely to be back.
Yeah.
So did you guys, how do you guys know each other?
Well, Jacinta, you can tell us a little bit more about your medical history if you're happy to, but we met when I was the post-transplant nurse practitioner.
Yeah.
So I looked after you in the early and now long-term after your transplant.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I think, gosh, casting my mind back to when I was 24 years old, I think, I was diagnosed with a rare blood cancer called myelofibrosis. Pretty young age to get a pretty serious diagnosis. And I think I was under the care of the lovely Max Wolf, who is a very stoic individual, which is always calming in light of life's challenges. And I managed that condition sort of conservatively for a couple of years until it got to the point where the toll on my body was getting very noticeable. It was time to luckily find a donor overseas from the US, which is still one of the most amazing things to think through in my life. Unlike my mother's propensity for slight magical thinking, I have not developed my donor's personality.
Does she think you've changed?
I think not, unfortunately.
Was she hoping?
Well, the rough corners of my personality have potentially been shaved by experience and time, but not so much the transplant process.
And we haven't witnessed any of those, so well.
You haven't got a green card.
No. but yeah, so that's how I met Yvonne, and I think it was Dave and all the amazing nurses. I think it was back at Royal Melbourne. I had this little room.
On 5 East?
Yeah, 5 East, that they let me decorate with a bunch of wall stickers. And I was 28 at the time, and it was, you know, it's amazing how you remember these things. I feel like it was probably pretty smooth sailing, but it probably wasn't. And there were some distinct times where I felt a bit close to the line. But, you know, I'm on the other side now. I'm working full time. Life is really wonderful, I'd say, even better than it was pre-transplant.
Yeah. Hey, even
yeah,
better.
Yeah, even better. So are you happy to share with us a little bit about your experience having a bone marrow transplant?
Yeah, sure. So I really liked the idea, you know, I'm someone that likes information. Not everyone's the same and everyone has like a different emotional response to these things and a need to process things. I think Dave and Yvonne worked out pretty quickly that I liked information, and something I really like doing in my job is actually making complex ideas, you know, understandable. So I described it like if you imagine a little house and you have a whole bunch of tradies come in and clean out the entire house, sweep the floor, remove all the furniture, do a full reno, sort of rebuild from the foundations up. That was my experience of a transplant. So high-dose chemo for a few days. I didn't have to have any radiation therapy. And then you know, what people don't tell you about cancer is there's just a lot of relaxing and hanging out. And I had some great chats to the nurses as I waited after they gave me this little magical bag of life and a bunch of blood products, obviously. Chatting to nurses, waiting until, I think it's called engraftment,
where that's right.
builds that they start building the house again, and you can see your blood count slowly come up. And then it's about a gradual process of just stepping through things carefully and cautiously and making sure all those sort of immunocompromised challenges are balanced and you've got enough magnesium. I got to hang out in the Royal Melbourne with all these different patients, and it was quite, you know, it was great people watching as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then slowly but surely I made it through the first 100 days. I had a few challenges, but that seemed to pass sort of slowly and steadily. I got very good at just sort of relaxing and looking at trees.
Yeah, like just like letting it happen?
Yeah, that's a good descriptor. And, you know, you can only control so much. So I think I remember getting a bit frustrated because I have a sense of urgency in life normally with the sort of wait until I knew that things were safe and I was better. And I remember Yvonne being very patient with me one day when I was like, oh, I really want to do yoga. And she's like, you can do yoga, Jacinta. Go do some yoga.
Yeah.
So it's also about just remembering to ask the questions about your quality of life that might get overlooked when you're so medicalized. Because for me then, doing yoga once a week was this really big thing in my life that was really exciting and probably good for my health as well.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah.
And you feel a bit maybe like new normal.
Yeah, I do like that phrase, and I've actually co-opted it into post-COVID world.
Yeah.
Because I feel like shout out to bone marrow transplant recipients, because you will be like the expert on isolation and hygiene and all of these things. So COVID hit and I was like, I've got this.
Yes.
Like, I know what this is about.
We'd already trained you years prior.
Yeah. I was like, there's this and there's going to be a new normal and we're all going to have to adapt. I think my new normal took time, and it's okay for these things to take time. But I did start back at work. I had a wonderful boss. He was actually, I think, the chair of where I worked, Maurice Blackburn, and he was really supportive of at sort of gradually returning to work and helping me. So I think I went back for one day a week at sort of 5.5 months, and that was honestly more for me than the service I was getting to the clients. I was very lucky because I had chosen to be reasonably open about that health journey, but also had an employer that understood the need to sort of support me re-enter the workplace. And also I had a desk job, so accommodating some of those physical challenges was probably a bit easier than if you were in manual labour or had different type of work that involves a bit more physicality.
So, yeah, and that was before working from home was a thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would have been a godsend. Working from home would have been fantastic. And nowadays you can ask for a reasonable adjustment, you know, get a letter from your doctor and then say, you know, can I work from home 3 or 4 days a week even? And your employer might be completely au fait with that, whereas for me, you know, it was a bit more of a discussion, and I sort of sat with how much I wanted to share, because I think there was an element of me not wanting to appear too vulnerable and it being a private journey that I was still digesting. But my honest advice is, you know, have those discussions with your workplace early, even before transplant, because it makes a big difference on the other side if people understand what you're going through and understand how big a process is. So I think I sent a link, obviously not medical advice, but a link to, I think there's a Mayo Clinic write-up about what an allogenic stem cell blood transplant is. And there was actually an education component where I really had to take my employer on the journey so they understood that I wasn't just taking sick leave because I felt like an extended holiday.
And you'd made up the word allogeneic.
As someone in my 20s.
Yeah.
You know, I need to explore other interests. So it took time, but I got there in the end. I had a lot of support though.
Yeah, I really like that idea of taking your employer on the journey and, you know, allowing them to participate in the education process and keeping them updated, because I suppose that philosophy applies in life. You're more likely to get people on board, aren't you, when you take them along with you?
Absolutely, Yvonne, and you're a wonderful communicator. I think teams are so important, and communicating early and regularly. I know you've got a lot on your plate, but I also had just a couple of lovely advocates in my workplace that when I couldn't communicate, I remember Lynn, a lovely colleague of mine, she was a bit of a mentor, you know, bolted into my boss's office and was like, she can't be replying to emails. Do you understand how serious this is?
Shout out to Lynn.
You know, that sort of thing's important, as well as knowing what your basic rights are. So I think it is probably worth having a chat to your employer early with some medical information so that they kind of know and they can get their head around it. And look, if you want to take a year off to fully recover, they can plan for that as well. They can recruit, they can backfill. It's better for everyone. It's harder in physical roles. You might have employment challenges there because you have to be fit for what they call the inherent requirement of your jobs, or you have to have a reasonable adjustment. You have to have some understanding with your employer. So everyone's facts are different. Early and often, I think, is a really good tip. That being said, in the midst of a transplant, I was not doing any work. I was not talking to work people. I had my partner at the time had a WhatsApp group to update people. Very handy when you have a mother that emails 120 of her closest friends updates regularly. So those sorts of things help as well, because you're not carrying the mental load of all of that, which I think, you know, is a lot. You just want to run your own race and focus on your health and your family, and that's important.
How important was it for you to return to work after your bone marrow transplant?
Oh, for me, it was so important. Everyone's different. You know, some people have complete changes and some people really reevaluate life. And I do distinctly remember feeling a need for a slower pace for a while. And I remember there was a period where I was trying, I think when I was going from 3 to 4 days, where it was a little bit hard. And I was thinking, oh, you know, this is a bit of a challenge. And wouldn't it be nice to move to the seaside?
You know, open up a florist and a cafe.
Yeah. And, you know, wonderful life choices that I think I would have been equally happy with. But in hindsight, I'm glad I pushed through, because for me it was really important. Like, it's interesting, I haven't talked about being a bone marrow transplant that much. It wasn't something I advertised at work. I mean, it was quite obvious because I had no hair. But my clients really liked that because I looked like really tough.
Right,
so,
yeah.
You know, yep. When I was litigating, they were like, oh, she's going to be really tough. Like,
she's a survivor.
Get me all the benefits. So you have to push through a little bit. But for me, it was the best thing I've ever done, because it's led to a lot more wisdom and a lot more opportunity and, you know, really a wonderful life.
So how did you know you were personally ready to go back to work and then professionally ready to go back to work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think you gave me some advice around this time, because it was about 5.5 months, which is a little early. I remember thinking I was starting to get a little bit bored. I could feel my cognitive self coming back. I like to think that I didn't have a lot of sort of chemo brain or whatever they call it, but oh my gosh, did I have chemo brain? I look back at these text messages I was sending, and people that know me well will tell you I'm a terrible speller at the best of times.
Yeah.
But I was obviously firing off some text messages to my best friend Ella in the UK that were very incoherent. So mental clarity was a factor.
Yeah.
And like, when you start to feel a little bit bored, you know, that's a good sign that maybe you are ready to slowly relearn some of those networks that are still there. They've just had a little holiday.
Mm.
And I had a really lovely colleague. She used to proofread my letters, because I was like, you know, I still need my letters proofread. I was really struggling with basic sentence structure sometimes, but I had this safe space, and it came back really quickly once I had these kind of support structures in place. And they weren't spelt out. They were just sort of
like informal support.
Informal, yeah. They were just kind people that I worked with that knew that maybe checking my letters was really a good idea.
That's incredibly special.
Yeah.
It wasn't formalized, it was sort of implied. Do you think that whole, you know, that communication that you spent so much time on early on, you know, with your employer, doing it comprehensively and frequently, do you think that played a part in how the rest of the team reacted and came to the fold as well?
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes it's just also about establishing trust and rapport with your employer. And you don't have to give them all the information, but you have to give them enough information so people with different responsibilities can manage those. You know, they've got a responsibility to make sure your workplace is safe. They've also got, if they're a business, a responsibility to, you know, make sure that they can do that and pay people at the same time. So I think that openness and trust really did make a difference. And I think a lot of people get a little bit too process orientated around these things, but really it's a conversation. I mean, I had formal return to work plans that I updated, but it wasn't overly burdensome. It was really, how are you going? You know, let's just plan it from the start. So we do 3 weeks at this many hours, 4 weeks at this many hours, and slowly increase. So having some structure, but also Yeah, just having a chat and being reasonably open. That was I learned a lot about vulnerability. As lawyers, we like to pretend that we're really tough and, you know, we've got our game face and we sit at these litigation negotiating tables and we practice our poker faces. And you know what? I'm all for bringing your whole self to work to a degree. You know, you don't need to tell someone when you're crying over your oats at breakfast because your hormones are off the charts because you're in early menopause. But you need to bring your whole self to work to some extent, and asking for help or just saying, can you give me a hand while I readjust, was really important. And it was amazing who showed up once you started.
Unexpected people.
Yeah. Well, people that I always know, like, I'm very lucky. Everyone I work with is generally a lovely person, but people surprise you. You know, sometimes you felt like people just wanted to hear the story because they like the drama a bit, but they were just very genuine, compassionate people that were pretty no-nonsense about it. They were just like, okay, let's do it. And that was my main boss. He was delightful. I'd walk into his office with, you know, so I've been diagnosed with an incurable blood cancer, and he'd be like, okay.
That's a poker face.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's good to talk within the boundaries of what you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
Were there any barriers or any specific troubles that you had coming back to work?
Yeah, I remember being quite anxious about public transport because at 6 months, obviously, and I think now that...
And that's probably our fault. We will take responsibility for that around the public transport thing, right, Alex?
Yeah, it's true. We probably planted that fear.
Yes.
Yeah, it's probably a reasonable and proportionate fear.
Yeah.
So I did drive into work or have my partner drop me off, and now I ride an e-bike, which I love because I'm part of the cyclist community, sort of. Cyclist adjacent.
Yes.
So there was a fair bit of anxiety. There was also anxiety about looking different. I think it was very interesting how whilst I was sick with this very significant illness for 4 years, no one could really visibly see it. And then the moment you come back without hair, losing a bit of weight, with a Hickman scar, you know, all of a sudden people are like, are you okay? And I'm like, guys,
I'm recovering.
Yeah, I'm so much better. Yeah, so I think that anxiety is normal, and it is really important just to, I'd say for me, know your personality, but do maybe 80% of what you think you can do to start, because it's much easier to build up than go to a level and come back again. So if you're desperate to go back to work and you think, oh, I could manage 3 days a week, I'd start with two and just see how you go.
That's really good advice, because going too hard too early and then having to pull back is not only potentially difficult physically, but also emotionally, you know, and difficult on your mental health.
Yeah.
There's the whole issue around confidence and, you know, you mentioned vulnerability before, and, you know, trying to kind of keep those in check I think is really important. So that's great advice. How did you go when you went back to work? Because I know that things like eating well and physical activity is really important to you as well, Jacinta. How did you go managing all of those other things that you'd invested so heavily in early post-transplant when you then had to also incorporate returning to work?
Yeah, I think a wise friend of mine once said, you know, sometimes you have to put your own oxygen mask on first. And I think it's really, you know, you think of these processes as you're playing the long game, right? You can't control all the things that are happening to your body. You can't control, you know, a COVID outbreak, having to do certain things. But what you can really control is if you can plan, and it is hard financially depending on what your financial circumstances are, but you can plan your needs first and foremost. And for different people, that looks differently. For me, I had really supportive friends and family, but going back to work, I actually tapped into this network of amazing, incredible lawyers like Em, and, you know, that I could debrief with about this process. And actually that community really helped, because I could talk about those anxieties. But these are special people. These are people that work with people with disabilities or, you know, work injuries. You know, there's an implied understanding. But I would seek out support networks, whether they're formal or informal. I didn't really get into the survivorship groups. For me, one, I was a lot younger than most people with myelofibrosis. You know, most people with that diagnosis are in their 60s, so it's a very different life stage than a 28-year-old.
Yeah.
I did find that just keeping in touch with the care team really helped with that continuity when I had some other unexpected life events happen. So you're going to pace yourself and put your own oxygen mask on first. And I did see a psychologist for years. The trigger for that was actually a relationship breakdown after the transplant. Mm. But that was invaluable because it's compulsory processing space, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I like the way you said that, compulsory processing space.
Yeah. So, yeah, each their own, but, yeah, support networks. And exercise is important. Like, it's hard to manage sometimes, but even if you're just walking to work, that's really important. And you've invested all of this time and energy in your transplant. Like, let's give it our best shot.
Yeah, and you still have to pedal on an e-bike.
Yeah, you do. I had that debate recently. I was like, I still have to pedal, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, people diss e-bikes, but they still require a bit of work.
Yeah. And I wear my Hi-Viz and it's blue and I love it. So.
Yeah, great.
Your experience has been really good returning back to work, but I think it's fair to say that that's not the case for everyone.
People have a variety of experiences, both in terms of their pre-existing or prehistorical relationship with their employer and their fellow colleagues. Some people are self-employed. So there's a whole lot of different stories that people bring to their transplant experience. So, you know, what we're really interested in hearing is some tips from you both as a transplant recipient, survivor, if that's how you'd like to call yourself, but also as a lawyer working in this field.
Yeah, so obviously, typical lawyer, we like to say always, you know, get your own legal advice on your facts because, as you said, you know, it changes for everyone, but some really important practical things to think about right from almost early diagnosis stage is first, be aware you may have income protection under your superannuation. So depending on who your superannuation provider is, you might actually have been paying for some form of income protection already. And it's really important that you're across that because that can obviously be a huge financial barrier that's lifted. And the other thing is be cognizant of what supports you can engage with through government. So they're constantly changing, but at my time, I think my partner was eligible for a carer's stipend or something like that. And then, you know, employers are diverse. There are great employers and there are employers that want to be great and there are employers that really just don't care about their people that much. And as much as it might be difficult to get to a situation where for whatever reason you can't meet the requirements of your job, you might be a trucker required to lift, you know, 15, 20 kilo packages, bending, lifting, twisting all day long. Mm. That is going to be far too physically demanding. And the way those rosters work, it might be really difficult to accommodate. So you might have to, you know, gently sever those ties and then look at some reinvention. And that can be really difficult on family groups because it might put a lot of financial strain as well as psychological strain on people. But do have the discussion because you're doing yourself a disservice unless you say, can we talk about what this looks like? Can we talk about a return to work plan? You'd be amazed at people that have someone in their world that has a story around, you know, experiences with cancer or illness, and they might be willing to accommodate you in ways that you didn't even imagine. And ask your doctors for support. You know, you have a wonderful team here at Peter Mac that really will give you that support. They will help you write those letters. You don't have to do it on your own. The other really practical thing is medical evidence. I think we understandably are quite private about these things and don't always want to share much more than, you know, Jacinta has a medical illness and she's off work. But I was talking about this morning actually, and it's really important in the context of a bone marrow transplant. That's a very significant health undertaking and you do need to give some information and your employer will probably benefit from that. Otherwise, they have the right to sort of send you off for an independent quote-unquote medical assessment, which honestly, if you're a transplant survivor, you're probably going to be fine in terms of it coming down in your favour. But it's one less hassle that you can avoid is if you get a clear medical certificate, maybe with a little bit more information than normal, explaining what you can do and what your journey might look like. And that's where your doctors can support you as well. Mm-hmm. You obviously have sick leave and annual leave entitlements that you can use first if you're looking at income and make sure you're aware of those. But also, you know, you might need to assess where you want to go and your identity a bit, and that can be really disruptive and hard. So you might want some psychological support to negotiate those challenges because every now and then you will have a shonky employer that doesn't really care about people and your energy is not worth going into that process unnecessarily, and hopefully there'll be other opportunities, and tap your support networks if they're not. But simple things like insurance as well are really important.
Mm. So in terms of psychological support, just, you know, for our audience, obviously that's something that you can talk about with your transplant team, also with your GP as well.
Yeah.
You can get a mental health plan and see a counsellor or a psychologist in the community, but it is a conversation you should have with your transplant team. Around other supports, and just since you've touched on people who perhaps want to move away from the work they've been doing for a long time, are there some well-established supports out there for people to retrain? So, you know, vocational retraining.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so many options. First, I would say know your rights first, mm-hmm. and then look at your options. There's a lot of wonderful pro bono services providers, a lot of law firms that provide employment advice, often for free for a 1-hour consultation, and they might do it over the phone. So know your rights, so know where those boundaries are for yourself in terms of what they do need to do and don't do. In terms of retraining, there is also a lot of options out there now. I think TAFE, I'm not completely across the latest offerings, but they're highly subsidised. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be a really good time to become an expert in AI.
Yeah.
It wrote this podcast for me and I'm just reading it. The reality is our identities, especially I think maybe sometimes men, are very closely linked to our jobs, but we're more than that. And, you know, I did have a period where I changed jobs for a while and I have moved out of the more commercial-facing side of where I'm at. And you need to really think of your whole life in terms of where your values sit, because if you're dealing with an employer and it's just hard, you know, plan it by all means financially, but then you might just want to cut your losses.
Is there somewhere a website that people can go to that has a comprehensive but consolidated piece of information about where people can find out their rights?
Yeah, so look, the biggest one is probably Fair Work Australia. Mm-hmm. It's a government website and they're getting better at plain English advice. I feel like lawyers really need to work on that though, because they love a bit of jargon. But
coming from the medical field, I understand.
Yeah,
I see you.
And then, you know, all the big law firms, Maurice Blackman being one of them, will have free consultations and advice sheets. But I think Fair Work's probably the first and foremost. There are other rights that you might have if you feel like you're being subject to particular behaviours because of your need for support, so disability discrimination, those sorts of things. And there's a Victorian Human Rights Commission and Australian Human Rights Commission. Also really good info sheets, much more plain English.
I'll pop those in our show notes so viewers can just scroll down and have a look.
But those three government ones are probably the best place to start. And you might have a family member that you can also delegate out, you know.
Oh, good advice.
Delegate.
Keep them busy. Give them a goal.
People
so
want to help.
Leave you alone. You can say, please summarise, and use the chatbot. Please summarise my workbot rights, but please check all the legal advice, you know, off these websites so you can, you know, work out what you need to do. And be aware that if you do get to a point of conflict, there are time limits that apply. So you probably want to get advice sooner rather than later. And I'm talking about, you know, within a week rather than, you know, 4 or 5 weeks if they're threatening your employment and you want to maintain your job and those sorts of things.
Okay, that's good. Timely advice
is good.
Okay.
I don't know, do you guys have a health justice arrangement here? There's sometimes health justice partnerships that work with hospitals as well, and they might have a lawyer, and I'm not sure whether that's something we have at Peter Mac, but it's also something that I think has helped people over time, because they get that early advice in the context of all their healthcare, which is, I know, what you guys do really well in the transplant centre. It's sort of a one-stop shop. The social worker comes in, looks after you, the haematologists, the nurse practitioners, the nurses. It's quite amazing.
It might be worth talking to your social workers or your individual hospitals to see if they have a health justice service that they offer.
Yeah, absolutely.
We could talk to you all day for lots of reasons. If you had to give our listeners one or two pieces of advice, a bit of a take-home message, what would you suggest?
There's a lot of, I think, things I've learned about myself and community and workplaces through this journey. I think there's something to say for being your own advocate and, you know, ask questions and don't feel disempowered just because you feel disempowered by your body and a process. You know, talk to people, ask questions, seek help, seek assurance, because that's really a big way of getting a little bit of control in a landscape that otherwise is awash with the unpredictable.
Mm.
And also, I know it's a cliche, but I do think being a bit kind to yourself is really important. Like, if ever there's a space to just expect a bit less and it to be okay, it's when you're fighting for your life with blood cancer and a stem cell transplant, you know?
Amen.
You'll come out the other side, and what's the worst that can happen? Well, the worst that can happen is you can die, so you're hoping to avoid that. The other side is, you know, you might lose a job, you might lose some friendships, you might have to rebuild, but you'll be here, and that's the most important thing for your loved ones and for the community and for the team. And it's really the biggest battle of your life, but you guys will be fine.
Thanks, Jacinta. That's a great place to say thank you. And
here's to another decade.
Absolutely. Happy anniversary.
I'll report back in another 10 years.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, and hope you've enjoyed the podcast as much as we have. Just a reminder that although our Straight and Merry team are experienced healthcare professionals, we are unable to give individual medical advice. If you have a medical query, please speak to your treating team. See you next time at the Straight and Marrow, and don't forget to subscribe to receive podcast updates. And for more information about ARROW, the Bone Marrow Transplant Foundation, go to arrow.org.au.